Hey, good morning and happy Thanksgiving in real time. Gratefully you showed up to the program today. I'm Brian, Seattle area, Washington and California attorney. Some background in coaching youth through high school football, and I've taught at a bunch of West Coast clinics for high school coaches on student-athlete development, trying to keep the kids between the buoys so they don't sabotage themselves with the social media and they can go get that scholarship and on to bigger and better things. Pretty exciting times at the pro sport level. We've got the currently FBI criminal investigations into the NBA, the NFL, and Major League Baseball all going on at the same time. So, you know, stay tuned. There's going to be changes coming up, I would guess, with federal oversight. Anytime the FBI shows up, it's pretty much a done deal. So we'll see what comes up with that. So for today, the incentive, the kind of the theme for today is from Charlie Munger, and I love this quote. Charlie always says, "Show me the incentive, and I'll show you the outcome." You've probably seen him at a few of the interviews, and somebody's got a five-minute wind-up question, and he just says, "Hey, show me the incentive, and I'll tell you how that's going to go." So we could probably end the program today on that, and we'd be fine, but we'll continue on a little bit more. And I've got a hypothetical for you to think of as we go along here. And I want you to think of it on a personal level as a sports parent. That might hit a little bit closer home. So let's say you have a daughter and she really wants to become an NFL agent. So she's doing all the right things, staying on track. She saw Jerry Maguire as a kid and she wants to become an NFL agent down the road. So she's going to go to law school and stay on track, pass all those background checks. Currently, your daughter is on the local college basketball team. And she's on a group text with three other teammates. So a total of four on the group text. College kids, you know how that goes. Two of the teammates on the group text start talking about how they landed a no-show job at the campus bookstore. So that means they get paid, they don't got to show up to work. It's wage theft, and it's also an improper benefit, because your average student can't go up to the bookstore and say, "Give me one of those no-show jobs like the student athletes." So we know it's wage theft. We know it is an improper benefit, which is going to put the program in jeopardy. And your daughter, who did nothing wrong, is just on the group text, and now she has knowledge of these violations. Absent-mindedly, she clicks a thumbs up emoji without thinking about it, just because, you know, that's what they're doing on text. Also, we have that fourth student-athlete on the group text, and she is staying quiet. So we've got the two student-athletes involved in the violations. You've got your daughter who just clicked a thumbs-up emoji, but she's not doing any illegal stuff or violations. And we have the silent student-athlete who has completely ghosted the conversation. So as a sports parent, how are you going to handle that? Because this is going to become an issue. And maybe also kind of think of it from different POVs. Think of it as a sports parent. Think of it as an attorney who's going to represent your daughter during an investigation that comes up on this. And then also think of it as the compliance attorney for the university. You've got these 18 to 22-year-old kids. You're gonna wreck their day, make them unemployable for the next 50 years. How are you going to handle that? And this is the kind of stuff that comes up at the college level all the time. We'll talk a little bit more of that as we go along. So let's jump in here. This is kind of our kind of one thing we want to think about too, is this is our client, and we've got the cool kid table up there with the NFL and the NCAA. You've got the agent over there for the revenues, and you know, sometimes there's a conflict between the agent and the player. The agent doesn't get paid unless the player gets paid. Sometimes the player's on the Wheaties box, and sometimes they end up in the Wonder Bread car down in Talladega with a Fig Newton sticker on the front windshield. It just depends. You got to make sure you find the right agent that is aligned with the client. And then we have the relationships. We got the we got the grabbers, you got the enablers, you've got the sycophants, because they want a piece of that fame, and they're always looking for a payout. You got the second cousin showing up that you haven't seen for 20 years, and they like a dollar or two. And I love the story about Michael Irvin. He was on the Warren Sapp podcast. You can find it on YouTube. It's a pretty fun clip. So Michael Irvin, the playmaker at Dallas Cowboys, he was heading down to New Orleans for the Super Bowl. And Michael Irvin took down $150,000 in cash to hand out to the family, the friends, the entourage. So over the course of the week, Michael Irvin hands out $150,000 in cash to all the people that are with him. And Irvin gets home, and a month later, the credit card bills start showing up. Turns out the entourage, the family, the friends pocketed the $150K, and they maxed out his credit cards. So that's the kind of thing you got to be worried about at the cool kid tables with the agents and the Hollywood celebs and the people hanging on. So the reason I bring that up is we're down there in the bottom left, as you can see, and we're not sitting at the cool kid table. The client needs somebody that can be a trusted advisor, kind of detached from that situation. And that's really where we come in, is to be that person that they can go to and try to get some good counsel, and we're not grabbing out for that cash. And it's a funny story with Michael Irvin, but keep in mind, there was a story that came out, you probably saw it on ESPN back in 2016. The National Bureau of Economic Research did a study. You know, the average career for the NFL guys are about 3.5 years, and after 3 years, roughly 78% of these guys are out of cash. So it's funny for Michael Irvin, but not everybody is at that level. They're in the league and they're out and they're broke. So they need somebody outside that table to protect them as they go along. So this is our roadmap for today. We'll do an intro. We'll look at some client management skills, cognitive bias, and that's kind of the high level stuff that you need to know if you do sports law, family law, whatever kind of law you do. That skill set for client management is so important. You could be the guy that graduates first in your class at Duke. You pass 2 bar exams without studying. You are able to memorize the 500-page collective bargaining agreement on a first read. You've got that technical skills. That ain't going to help you when the client is throwing furniture off the 14th floor balcony at his Miami Beach condo. And that's a real story that we'll talk about coming up here. You got to have the client management skills down and be able to keep these guys on track so they can stay in the league, so they can make that paycheck. Then we'll dive into the kind of the floor level stuff and the regulations and the violations and things like that. We'll look at the NFL agency regs and some actions with the agents. And the NFLPA is an absolute dumpster fire if you've been tracking that in 2025. We'll jump into the NCAA, look at investigations of student athletes for the no-show jobs and that kind of stuff. There's a big transgender policy change. And then we'll look at House versus NCAA. House versus NCAA is a massive watershed. You probably need a 2 to 3 hour CLE on that to get all the details, but we'll cover some of the main points on that. And then we'll look at the Washington State transgender policy, just as an example. I'm up here in Seattle, so that's what I know. And we'll kind of look at the differences between at the state level versus what we have at the NCAA level. Regardless of whatever side of the debate you're on with the transgender and the student athletes, hopefully we can all agree, and you've probably seen clips on YouTube, it's ridiculous when you see these middle-aged sports parents are down at the track and they are screaming at the 15-year-old transgender kid, screaming at them to get off the track. It's not the way I want to handle it. You don't need to be bullying the 15-year-olds. The 15-year-old didn't have any say when they implemented the policy at the state level. So if your client, if you do divorce law and the clients are bent out of shape about that and they're screaming at the kids, take it up with the school district, with the state, but don't be verbally abusing the 15-year-olds out there. So lawyers, here's what you got to look at too. This is a tough ratio, and it is an incentive for bad decision making. We got roughly 1 million attorneys nationwide, and there's only so many seats at the table. You got 32 teams. You have less than 2,000 players. NCAA got 1,000 schools and 500 athletes. So there's only so many seats, and that can lead to bad behavior if you really, really want a seat at the table. So you got to decide ahead of time what you're willing to do, and more importantly, what you're not willing to do, because there's some dicey stuff that comes up, especially at the college level, where you got to make a decision. And you're gonna go along with the program just this once, where you do that and put your bar license in risk. So you got to really think about that ahead of time. And this is one example. The NFLPA, this is for agents. If you are an agent slash lawyer, you're required to advise the player and notify the NFLPA if there is a contract violation by the team or a CBA violation. Sounds pretty easy. That creates conflict between the agent and the player. If the player is the worst player in the league, he's barely hanging on. Sometimes he's on the roster. Sometimes he's at Amazon moving boxes. He's just barely hanging on. And if the team violates his contract, you got to notify him. And he's probably going to say, do nothing. Do not notify the NFLPA. I do not want to get blacklisted or get into any kind of trouble. Do nothing. That's not an option for the agent. They are required to notify the NFLPA to protect the collective. And that is a conflict that does come up. At the NCAA level, if you are the compliance attorney at the University of Miami back in the late 80s, early 90s, that is a full day on the job. You are obligated to report violations that happen. And there can be a conversation in house where they say, hey, we're playing in the national championship game next week. Let's not do anything. And that's the kind of stuff that comes up. You got to do the right thing for the client. You've got to protect your license. So you really want to think about these things ahead of time. You don't want to wait until these events come up, and you've got to start thinking it through when you are under pressure and you're just not thinking straight. Assumptions. There are changes all the time. None of this stuff is evergreen. And you got a lot of different laws to keep track of: federal law, state law, NFL regulations, NCAA, conferences, schools, high school administration rules. And this stuff changes all the time. I just had to submit a new rule for you guys that based on a change at the NCAA level a couple days ago. It's changing all the time. So when issues come up, double check so you don't get yourself in trouble with the clients. It's not evergreen. It's state by state, and it is school by school. So just kind of keep that in mind. And I use this as a fun example for myself, and maybe think of one for yourself and your clients if you work with agents or whatever. But we're wrong on everything all the time. We got to double check. And so the example I use for myself just as kind of a cartoon example. So I just kind of have a quick check for myself that I got to double check before I jump in and lead somebody down the wrong path. So you look at this little map here, and you got Earth, and if you were to try to take Earth's closest neighbor, we always talk about Mars. We're going to Mars. We've got Elon Musk. He's building a rocket ship, held together with duct tape, maybe a couple lawn chairs, maybe a cup holder. So we always think Mars is going to be our closest planet. But if you look into it, you get the answer down there with the link. The answer might surprise you, and the correct answer for who is our closest neighbor for most of the year, that could win you a bar bet, or it could get you punched in the face. Don't call Ryan. Also, for assumptions, we assume that the client understands what we're talking about, and we get ourselves into trouble because if we've been doing something for 10, 15 years, the gap between what we know and what we believe the client understands is massive. We just kind of shorthand this stuff. We use industry terminology, and the clients, especially if they are college or high school sports parents, they're not going to know any of this stuff, and they get it all mashed up between what's allowed at the high school level for student athletes and what's allowed at the college level, and they mess up the datelines and all that. So we really got to break this down and try to keep it simple, clear, and on repeat. And I love this poster. I took this on the Washington State Ferry System, and this is what they want the mom to keep track of. She's on board by herself. She's got three kids under 10. And the car deck is exploding, and she's got to go through this. It's kind of ridiculous. So it's a cartoon example to just keep in mind that we have to really double check on this stuff and be very clear with our clients when we're communicating these requirements in sports law. Let's talk about the kind of funny stuff that can come up. These are high profile, high maintenance, competitive people that are in sports. And this is the kind of unexpected 3 a.m. phone call you might get as an attorney. So Eugene Robinson was playing for the Falcons when he was arrested the night before he was scheduled to play in the Super Bowl. for solicitation of a prostitute while the family were in a nearby hotel. But it gets worse. Robinson had just won the Bart Starr Award for high moral character in the NFL just days before the arrest in Miami. So unexpected, and that's the kind of stuff that can come up. Maybe you represent college coaches on their contracts, and this is something that can come up. So in December 2001, Coach O'Leary was newly appointed as the head coach at Notre Dame football. That's the biggest brand in the NCAA. And he resigned just 5 days into his tenure due to discrepancies found on his resume. It's kind of a fun game. If you want to go online and try to look up NYU Stony Brook University, where's the campus, what kind of programs they have, not going to find it. You can find NYU and you can find Stony Brook, but this is a combination, sort of a made-up mashup of universities. It doesn't exist, and nobody caught it. But the funny part here, too, is Coach O'Leary, he's a great coach, and he'd been in the game for 20 years since 1980 on the college campuses, coaching college ball. I would like to know how somebody submits resumes and work history and education history to college programs for 20 years, and nobody catches it. My guess, speculation, incentive came into play. You win 10 games a year, and nobody is looking too closely. You win two games a year, this probably comes up. And this is the sort of stuff where you work on college coaching contracts, you wouldn't expect this thing to come up. And if you do employment law with college coaches, this is the kind of thing you gotta deal with. And it's gonna be very high profile. Not a big deal if it's off the radar, but if it's on ESPN all day long, it makes the job that much more complicated. So here's what we got for decision making, and you got to keep track of this stuff. Life in the fishbowl is probably no fun for these guys when they do something stupid. I do something stupid, nobody cares. But if your client in the NFL does something stupid, it's on YouTube forever. So we want to talk about three things. First one is table selection. Think about Michael Irvin. Kind of a funny story, but they're maxing out his credit cards, pocketing stacks of cash. Who's at your table? It's going to be really important because these guys are broke 3 years after retirement. Stop doing lists. Kind of think about Eugene Robinson playing at the Super Bowl and getting arrested the night before. So you got to really get those vices under control. And then you got to have what I call the 24-hour rule. The triggers come up. These guys are competitive, and they just can explode at a moment's notice. You've probably heard of the wide receiver Antonio Brown. Got into all kinds of trouble when he was with the Pittsburgh Steelers. And at one point, Brown was throwing furniture off his 14th floor balcony at his Miami Beach condo. It's a real thing that happened. So you can be the best technician attorney in the country, but if you don't have the client management skills down and working with them on the stuff on the front end, trying to keep the clients, between the buoys so they're not getting themselves in trouble. It's going to be a short career for the client. And the Steelers eventually just shipped him out of town, ended up in Oakland. So after throwing furniture off the 14th floor balcony down toward the pool deck, Antonio Brown thought it would be a good idea to charter a hot air balloon to take him to the first day of practice. You can't be doing that when you're Antonio Brown. It'd be kind of funny if you're Tom Brady or Kobe Bryant, because they're at the gym at 4 o'clock in the morning. But you gotta know the situation in Antonio Brown, probably a top 20 wide receiver, and he kind of wore out his welcome wherever he went. So have these conversations with the client on the front end to keep them out of trouble. Who are you hanging out with? What's on your calendar? And what are you going to do when the trigger comes up? So let's jump into cognitive bias. This is kind of a fun story. So we have the sports dad. He decided to sue his son's high school track coach for $40 million because the son was kicked off the team for too many unexcused absences. So hopefully there's joint liability here. If you are a high school track coach, you probably get a windbreaker and a whistle, but you don't got $40 million in the bank. And then when your lawsuit is getting mocked around the world, you got to take a close look at that. But this is where it kind of starts with the youth sports. And I've got a few more stories like this, just little short things to keep in mind, because everything starts at that youth and high school level and building up those skill sets as far as life skills and decision making. So cognitive bias is kind of a mental shortcut that leads to errors in thinking. Our brains are making snap judgments based on our past experiences, and it helps us simplify the flood of information that's coming in. So this is something that we all have. We've got a busy day ahead of us, so we're making those snap decisions, and it can be the wrong decision. And like I always say, the brain is not our friend, and you can quote me on that. It makes up 2% of our body weight, and it's chewing up 20% of the calories per day. So it's always looking for that shortcut and that cheat code. So confirmation bias, a good example of this might be Michael Jordan when he was with the Chicago Bulls. Jordan started with the Bulls in 1984, and the Detroit Pistons, under what they called the Jordan rules, would just beat the heck out of them in the playoffs, and the Bulls couldn't get past the Pistons. But Jordan, confirmation bias, he thought, well, maybe I just need more points. I'm scoring 37. Maybe I need 40 points. We'll do better. So that's confirmation bias. He believes information that supports his POV. But in 1990, you got a journeyman, no-name coach called Phil Jackson, who shows up in town. And Jackson was not the Zen master at that point. He's a first-year coach, and he's, imagine this conversation with the most famous, aggressive, competitive player on the planet. And Jackson and Tex Winters tell Jordan, we're switching it up. We're going to go to the triangle offense. And that means the ball's coming out of your hands. We're going to move the ball around, and you're going to score 10 points less per game. What do you say? Jordan was not happy with that, and they had a battle about that. Contrary information is ignored. They showed him what the triangle offense is all about. It's going to get you past the Pistons. And this could have gone very differently for Jordan if they couldn't talk him into this. But you got a first-year head coach. They switch up the offense. They take the ball out of Jordan's hands. He's scoring 10 points less a game. And they win the championship that same year. And they go on to win a total of 6 championships. So confirmation bias, I know it, I know. Be gone with your facts. You got to get on top of that. Self-serving bias, I'm special, you're not. And this can kind of come up with a good example would be kind of Coach O'Leary, the 20-year coach in college. He's kind of got that sketchy background with the education. Chances are Coach O'Leary was having conversation with the student athletes about integrity and doing the right thing, doing their own homework, didn't want to graduate on time and all that, having conversations with the coaches about integrity. But at the same time, Coach O'Leary's got that fake master's degree from NYU Stony Brook. So Coach O'Leary is saying, I'm special, you're not. And that's the kind of stuff that can come up for that the clients want to protect themselves. And it's, kind of the everyday example that we have is if I'm late for a meeting because of traffic, I'm doing the best I can. I've got a good excuse. But if you are late for that same meeting because of traffic, I see you as kind of a jerk. So it's the same set of facts, but I give myself a break and I'm going to blame you for doing the same thing. So the last one is the bubble bias, and this is where everyone agrees with me. You got the client in the bubble. They've got the grabbers. They've got the enablers. They've got the sycophants who want to hang around the player because of the fame and the money, and they're telling him that everything he does is right. So we got to keep track of that, and that's kind of the situation with Michael Vick. If you remember Michael Vick, he was the second highest player in the NFL with the Atlanta Falcons. And at the same time, he was running a dog fighting operation. Now, you can be at the dog park or you can be at the dog fighting match. And you got a choice on that. Who is at the table? Who are you hanging out with? And this is kind of an example of bubble bias where they just start to, believe their own hype because everyone's telling them they're doing the right thing. So you got to keep track of that with the clients. You got to have the client management side down, the table, the stop doing list. Got to have the trigger plan when things come up, and then you got to talk about the cognitive bias because sometimes the client is the problem. And kind of a fun example that I always use is if you look at the global fan base, we're here in North America, and we watch the NFL all year. It's 24/7 now, and so we think the NFL must be the most popular sport in the world. But if you look at the global fan base of the NFL compared to table tennis, ping pong, it's kind of surprising. but we're in the bubble, so we think it's the NFL. Get outside the bubble, and we find out you got a lot of people in Beijing who are playing and watching ping pong. So cognitive bias is kind of the game plan on it. You got to own it. Clients are going to have this, especially if they are high profile, high maintenance. They are right all the time. You can't tell me nothing. So you got to own it, have a plan, look for viewpoint diversity, disconfirming information, and then you want to have an open mind like Michael Jordan. He objected to the triangle offense, but he slowly came around to it. He says, you know, I might be wrong here. We'll try it out. And they go on to win the championship that same year in Chicago. So let's jump into the NFL. Here's a fun one. A small town cop is accused of paying a 10-year-old Little League pitcher $2 to throw bean balls at a batter. So if you are a cop, and you are paying 10-year-olds to throw baseballs at each other, that's not going to be a fun 18 months in prison. So you don't want to do that. It's hard to believe that this stuff goes on at the youth level, but, you know, it does. So let's jump in. NFL, if you hear of agents and contract advisors, those are the men and women that negotiate the player team contracts. They call an agent a contract advisor. Again, we have a ratio here that leads to the incentive for bad decision making. You've got less than 2,000 players in the league, and you've got roughly 1,000 agents. Would you as an attorney ever move to a town where there's 1,000 attorneys and only 2,000 possible clients? That's going to be a tough way to make a living. So that leads to bad behavior. And it's no joke on the background check. This is not an FBI job. You're not applying for the CIA, but they're going to do a 10-year background check on your employment. They will look at your social media history, see if there's any bad stuff going on there, and they're going to look into your spouse. They're going to look into your spouse and what he or she is doing to see if there's any way to blackball you from sitting down for the exam. If you fail the exam 2 times, the NFLPA will bar you for at least 5 years, and that's a polite way of the NFL saying to the person, you do not have the skill set to become an NFL agent. The NFLPA can remove the agent as well if the agent fails a skill exam. Let's say the agent's been in the game for about 10 years, but they're not keeping up to date on the salary cap and the PEDs and all the kind of technical things that come up. If the agent starts to slip, the NFLPA shows up and says, take the skills exam. If the agent fails the test, they are kicked out for at least a year and they can come back, pass a skills exam, and get back in. But the NFLPA is calling the shots because they are representing the players and they take a very tough line on the agents to protect the players. Also look down on the bottom right. This one is really scary because if the agent fails to sign a client to a team for 3 years, you're automatically kicked out. So think about that. If you're an agent, you've been telling everybody that you're now an NFL agent. You've got your ego invested in this. You haven't signed anybody to a team for 2 years and 11 months, and you're about to get kicked out and be embarrassed. That can lead to the agent making bad decisions like poaching clients or paying kickbacks to get clients. So you got to be aware of that. So if you are an attorney and you have the opportunity to work with prospective agents on the front end, which I recommend, you got to work out all the stuff on the front end to make sure that what they know what to do and what not to do before they get themselves into a bad situation. So you run through these hypotheticals. This is where you're going to get in trouble. Have a plan of action before you get there so you know what to do. So let's look at the regulations. Lots of stuff you must do and lots of stuff you must not do. Under 3A, this is the must do stuff. And the agent must report, as we talked about, known player team contract violations to the NFLPA. And if you represent one player, he's the worst player in the league. He's on the roster. He's over at Amazon. There's going to be a conflict. He wants you to sit on it, but you must report that to the NFLPA to protect the collective. Also, under 3A19, you must disclose to the player any kind of recruiting fees to get that player signed. So similar to real estate, you can have agent-to-agent referral fees. That's okay. There's a specific form that you send to the player. They look it over. They see what the fee is. They sign off on that, and you're good to go. And the reason they might do that is that agents might have a full house, and they can't take on any more players. And so they kick it over to somebody else. That's allowed, but you must disclose that to the player and get a signature on that. And again, that is certified agent to certified agent, and that comes into play as we go along here. Down below, you must report to the NFL if you are charged with a criminal offense. Maybe it's a drunken disorderly down in Miami. And you also have to report any kind of traffic violation over $100. Good luck getting a traffic ticket in California for less than $100. So the NFLPA is in your business if you are an agent, and they got lots of ways to kick you out, and they got lots of ways to bring in other people who really want this high profile job. And the NFLPA is responsible to protect the players. So they're going to be on you if you are an agent for those players. So lots of stuff you can't do as an agent in the NFL. So this one's important at the top. The agent can't provide money to a player, family member, or any other person as an inducement for agent services. So agent kickback, that's okay. Disclose it to the player. Agent paying kickbacks to people that are not qualified and certified, that's going to be a problem. And that will come up as we go along here in a few more pages here. Also, the agent cannot manipulate their endorsement fee commission to offset a contract commission. So for the player team contracts, the default commission for the agents is 1.5%. The cap is 3% for those player team contracts. What might happen, it can be, again, it's incentive drives everything, and the agent might say, you know what, I'm going to drop down my my contract commission fee to 0.5%, and what I'll do is I'll jack up the endorsement fee commission to get this guy on board. You can't be doing that. You have to disclose what your customary commissions are for both contracts and endorsements to the NFLPA, and if you start playing around with those, the NFLPA is going to have a conversation with you. And then you're going to go to a disciplinary hearing. Also, the agent cannot poach clients. The agent cannot initiate any communications with a player who is signed to another agent. And a player is allowed to initiate those communications. And the agent can then engage in on communications on those matters. And you got to be really careful about that. Again, incentive drives everything. Player shows up. And he says to a prospective agent, I'd like to talk to you about negotiating my next contract with the Dallas Cowboys. Then you can have those conversations. However, what the agent can't do is bring up the conversation on endorsement contracts with Nike. We know how this goes, but you want to make sure as an attorney, if you're doing this preventative maintenance, go through these hypotheticals. Don't bring that up. Because there's going to be a text information trail. There's going to be emails, voicemails that are going to come up that get the agent in trouble. So the player can initiate the communication. Then the agent can have those conversations. But the agent can't slide that conversation into other deals as well. Oh, also, this one's important too. Down at the bottom, the agent is allowed to send written advertising materials to those players who are represented, but it cannot be personalized. So you can't send out an Excel spreadsheet that shows very personalized information of the player, but you can send out a brochure, and that's not a problem. So let's go to the CBA. So this is between the players and the owners. It's coming up again, I think in 2030, so we got a few more years here. And some of this stuff, it's tough because it sounds simple. The rules are simple. But incentive drives everything, and they start making bad decisions. Services, you're expected to provide best effort as a player in full participation. It can be a problem if they start, embellishing injuries to try to get out of town and things like that, because that impacts the integrity of the game, and that does happen. Other activities, if the player wants to shoot a movie in the offseason, go skydiving, jump off the top rope, At the SmackDown, they can do that, but they got to get the club's approval before they start doing those activities off the field that can get them themselves into trouble. And then down below, you've got physical and mental condition. You must fully disclose physical conditions and mental conditions or the club will terminate the contract. Other stuff you got to do on the player team contracts and the CBA, skill and conduct. Keep in mind the club can terminate the player at any time for any reason.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is DRY, D-R-Y, all lowercase, DRY. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is DRY, D-R-Y, all lowercase, DRY. Please take a moment and write this down.
They don't like how you play on the field. They don't think you're going to play better next year. Personal conduct. And kind of the rule that the New England Patriots with Bill Belichick is he would wait until the player was 1 year away from their peak. They would kind of gauge that out, and they would trade the player 1 year away from their peak so they can bring in somebody else at a lower salary. Injury grievance, this becomes an issue if a player gets terminated from the team and he believes it was work-related. He then has 60 days to get a second opinion. He's got to pay for that. And if there's a conflict between the team doctor and the player doctor, then you go to binding arbitration. So the player, he plays on Sunday and he winds up with a compound fracture in the game. And what do you know? The team says, we're cutting you on Monday because we don't think you're playing very well. And the player says, I think this is work related. I think there's a worker's comp issue. Look at my leg. There's a bone sticking out. Got a compound fracture from the game. Team says, that has nothing to do with it. We just don't think you're playing very well. So this is the stuff that does come up, and there's a panel of workers' comp attorneys that are approved by the NFLPA. The agent is only allowed to provide a reference to one of those workers' comp attorneys on the panel. The player, however, is not obligated to use one of those attorneys, one of those workers' comp attorneys. Game integrity, the players must report any offers of bribes or offers to fix games, manipulating prop bets and things like that. And if you don't, the commissioner can terminate the contract. So that it's not up to the team, it goes to the commissioner and you are done. And again, this goes back to table selection. If the player's hanging out with the wrong kind of people off field, sometimes they're not your friends. And they show up and talk to the player and say, you're going to drop four passes. You're going to get three pass interference calls. I've got some prop bets on you and I'll give you some money after the game. Players got to be really smart about who they're hanging out with, because that's the kind of stuff that does happen, in the pro sports level. Down below, other provisions, the team, the player, and the agent must confirm that there's no undisclosed side deals, because we have a salary cap in the NFL. I think it's probably $279 million, so you can't have any sort of side deals. You got to get under that cap, and if there's any kind of a side deal, then that's going to be a real problem for the agent, the team, and the player. So let's jump into some specifics here. This is kind of a fun one. And this one's been going on since 2019, believe it or not. And this is agent versus agent on poaching. So Agent Bernstein was the agent for wide receiver Galladay. And the allegations are that Agent France started to poach Galladay to assist him on an endorsement autograph signing event. Player Galladay terminated Bernstein and signed with France in 2019. Bernstein filed a grievance against France for poaching his player. France, this is where it gets fun. So France denied any involvement with Galladay at pre-arbitration deposition, as well as the arbitration hearing. So he said, I did nothing wrong. But here you go. There's emails discovered that showed that France arranged for the autograph event and negotiated the contract with the venue. There's always an email trail. There's always text messages out there, so why bother? So the arbitrator ended up giving Bernstein $450,000 in punitive damages, and this was the first ever punitive award under the NFLPA. So that opens the door for future punitive damages for poaching, which is probably good, because these guys, there's only so many players to go around, and if you're poaching, it's not great for the league. So now if punitive damages are on the table, hopefully that will slow down that kind of bad behavior by the agents. The violations here under Section 3B14, engaging in dishonesty, lying in the emails, and under 3B21, poaching, initiating communications with the players. So now the next step is the NFLPA is going to go to the discipline part of the problem here. Agent France is probably going to be kicked out for a long time. We'll see what happens. This one's kind of fun too. This is Keyshawn. Throw me the damn settlement, Johnson. So this one's going on in the Los Angeles County Superior Court. It's not in arbitration because it's between an agent and Keyshawn Johnson as a non-agent. And this is a decade-old verbal contract, allegedly, where Keyshawn Johnson says Agent Ellison was going to pay him 1/3 of 3% for any client that agent took to Ellison, and then Ellison got signed to a team. But again, Keyshawn Johnson is not a certified agent. So we got to find out how this is set up between Agent Ellison and non-certified Agent Johnson. How is he paying Johnson 1/3 of 3% if Johnson is not an agent? So we'll have to see how that goes. So Johnson alleges that he was owed 1/3 of 3% commissions received by Ellison for negotiation of those contracts. And another agent chimed in. He said the situation could create a potential issue for Ellison if the players weren't aware of Johnson's stake in the decision to hire Ellison. So again, keep track of this one. It was first reported on TMZ. It's at the Los Angeles County Superior Court. It is not in confidential arbitration because we have an agent and we have a non-agent involved in the situation. So this one is from the archives, and it shows you how strict the NFLPA is with the agents. So this goes back to, you got to go to the Wayback Machine in 2013 when people were sending paper faxes. So there was an issue with the Denver Broncos. There was an offer deadline set for 2 p.m., and they meant it. The agent and the player signed and faxed in the papers at 1:53 p.m. Something got jammed up. Maybe there's no paper. Maybe the fax machine got turned off. Who knows? They faxed it in at 1:53. The signed offer shows up at 2:06, 6 minutes late, and the player gets released. So it's a six-minute delay due to the fax machine, apparently, and the agent got fined $25,000 and suspended for 6 months as an agent because of that. So you're taking a risk when you're sending in the fax that close to the deadline. But apparently, they did the best they could. They sent it in at 1:53, but it doesn't show up at the Broncos at 2:06. That's on the agent. You have fiduciary duties, which includes duty of care. You got to do everything you can to get those documents sent in on time. And the NFLPA has all kinds of ways to deal with these agents in the disciplinary hearings. They can do anything from putting a private note in the agent's file all the way up to kicking you out same day. And this is kind of an interesting one here. In 6D5, the NFLPA can prohibit the agent from taking on any new clients for a set period of time. So the agent's kind of maxed out. They're starting to drop the ball. And the NFLPA can say you're capped at representing 5 clients. We'll come back in a year and see how you're doing. But there's all kinds of mechanisms that the NFLPA can do to keep the agents in line. Bottom line, the NFLPA doesn't need you as an agent. They got plenty of people that want that job, and they're going to hold the agents accountable. 6 minutes, a six-minute delay costs this guy $25K and 6 months of his career. And you're probably not going to get a 5-star review from the client when this kind of stuff happens. Another one from the archives, I included this one because this guy was the biggest name in the league as an agent, Ben Dagra. And we get nothing. Because typically with arbitration and the disciplinary hearings, it's confidential. So we don't get all the good stuff that we could use on the outside to let us know kind of what to do. Because if you are like we'll say you're a personal injury attorney, you want to kind of find where the buoys are, you go to Westlaw, you bring up the case law, and it kind of tells you where those buoys are. But when it's confidential arbitration, it's not a lot of fun because we don't get any of that information. And this one would be good to see because we have the biggest name in the business. and there's 38 counts in the discipline complaint. So that would be good to see on the front end. If you're an attorney working with people that want to become an agent, you go through the bullet point list, do this, don't do that. But on the outside, we don't get to see what happened. All we get is this kind of high level press release, and off we go. So this guy was kicked out for 3 years and fined $200,000. Let's go to the strip club. Why not? This is hard to believe this happened. So, as I mentioned earlier, the NFLPA right now is a complete dumpster fire. They've got all kinds of stuff going on right now. And this guy, Howell, he was the NFLPA director, and he resigned after a short 2 years. Typically, if you somehow win that lottery ticket and you get into the door anywhere in the NFL, you typically stick around for a while. And this guy was out after two short years. This is one of the things that's hard to believe in the NFL when they're having, you know, daily contact with the families and they're high profile and everything gets out. So the report cited that Howell charged the union $700 for transportation to a Miami strip club and $2,000 for a trip to an Atlanta strip club with two employees during a company retreat. So you're doing a little team building down at the strip club, probably not a good idea. And then you turn in $2,000 of receipts to HR for reimbursement. It's hard to imagine somebody at the leadership level would do that. Not a good idea. If you're the NFLPA, if you're working for Disney, if you're working for Amazon, you're working for Apple, you don't go to the strip club for some team building and then submit receipts to the HR department. Self-dealing. So now we get a little bit more important. A strip club is embarrassing, but self-dealing. Now we have a FBI criminal investigation of the NFLPA. You want to pay attention to this as it goes along. So in May, ESPN reported that the FBI is investigating financial dealings between One Team Partners. It's a $2 billion NIL firm that was founded by the NFLPA and Major League Baseball Players Association to monetize the players' name, image, likeness. So it just so happens that Howell, who's top of the NFLPA, and Tony Clark, leader of the MLBPA, they held board seats at One Team. It's pretty interesting. So if these guys are fiduciaries of the players and they hold board seats on One Team Partners and maybe they're getting a little bit of payment for their time, that might be okay. What if there's some equity interest there? How do you fire One Team Partners or shut it down when there's that kind of conflict? So the FBI is looking into this to look for misuse of funds and self-enrichment. And there's FBI investigations going on now with the NBA, the NFLPA, and the MLBPA. There's going to be some changes coming up. So we'll see how this escalates, but it is ongoing, and it could get pretty dicey. So let's jump into fake injuries, which is not good because that goes to the integrity of the game. Anything that impacts the integrity of the game can lead to fans just jumping ship and finding something else to do. Maybe they don't watch the football game. They'll just go do a jigsaw puzzle. So an arbitrator ruled in favor of the NFL at a grievance hearing where then President J.C. Treader, who also resigned within about 3 days of the director of the NFLPA. So we got two guys at the top resigning within a week of each other, because allegedly he was encouraging running backs to exaggerate injuries to increase leverage during contract disputes. So you've kind of got that relationship between the players, the NFLPA, and the league itself. And you got to be working together to build up the league and keep that cash coming in. And if you have somebody at the leadership level encouraging running backs across the league to embellish injuries, that's not good. Goes to the integrity of the game, and that can lead to a loss of fans. So you got to be really careful with that kind of stuff. Here's the regs for that under the CBA. Article 2, Section 2. Parties will use their best efforts to see that the terms and conditions of the contracts and the CBA are carried out in full by the players. Got somebody from the leadership saying, well, let's fake the injuries. Can't be doing that. And Article 3, Section 1, the NFLPA cannot encourage any kind of work stoppage. And if you're showing up across the league, telling running backs to kind of sandbag it, that is a mini work stoppage. So you can't be having that when these guys are trying to keep the money truck coming in. So let's jump into the NCAA. Kind of love this. It's a sign of the apocalypse. And you've got a youth hockey league that suspended 3 7-year-olds for playing in an unsanctioned outlaw league. So they're going after 7-year-olds for being outlaws. It's hard to believe, but gets more competitive, younger and younger, and this is the kind of stuff that's going on. So the NCAA, tons of changes going on. Pre-2021, you could get a scholarship, but if you wanted to transfer, you had to sit out a year. 21 to 25, we have scholarships, name, image, likeness, and also they started to loosen up in the transfers. You could get a one-time transfer if you're in good condition with your education, not a problem. And then we get to 2025, and it is no longer amateur sports. So right now, we've got scholarships, we have name, image, likeness, we can do multiple transfers, and also you can do revenue share with the schools. And this is going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. One thing I'm going to kind of watch for with the revenue share, that's between the schools and the student athlete, is, these kids are 18 to 22 years old. And if you're 18 years old, you show up on campus, they give you $10,000. Might be incentivized for the kid to take $500. Kid pays that to his classmate who's on student loans. The classmate does homework for the student athlete, and that frees up time for the student athlete to go out and get YouTube endorsement deals. So that's the kind of stuff that can happen when you show up with $10,000 to the student athlete and they're 18 to 22 years old. So we'll have to see how that plays out. For the athletic programs, you got 360 Division I programs, and that's primarily what we're talking about today. More money, more problems. If you are the compliance attorney at one of these schools, issues with the schools, the teams, the coaches, the players, the families taking kickbacks, boosters, brands, agents. And you're going to find it's going to be the same kind of set of problems year in, year out, because they are 18 to 22. You've got these family members who are willing to take kickbacks. So it's going to be the same kind of problems that come up every year. And I keep talking about this. Got to have those conversations on the front end. Show them case law. Show them hypotheticals. Give them some information on the front end so they can make good decisions when these issues come up. Here's what we got for the football players. We have 77,000 players out there playing NCAA football. Only 1.5% are going to go pro. What does that mean? You got a lot of players that want to get paid, and that can lead to a lot of bad behavior. You got to keep that in mind. 18 to 22 years old, I'll keep going back to that. Same set of problems that come every year. And there are certain things that you got to make sure that we are communicating with these players to keep them out of trouble. Let's do some press releases from the NCAA. Gambling. This is one that's going to come up every year, and there's probably about 4 or 5 cases out there at the NCAA website with players who are manipulating games. You're 18 to 22, and that's what you do. We have the NCAA investigating 3 players, Robinson, Vasquez, and Weaver, and they played Fresno State, San Jose State. They were released from their respective teams and are no longer enrolled at their schools. What do? Robinson and Vasquez discussed over text messages. Remember in the NFL, we had email messages. The guy said, I did nothing wrong. He did a deposition under penalty of perjury. There's nothing to see here. Then he got some emails. And here we got some text messages going back and forth where Robinson planned to underperform on individual props, told his boys, they placed some bets, and won some money. So maybe the prop bet is I need to get 10 points, and Robinson says, I'm going to stop at 7 points. Place your bets. We'll split the money. And that's the kind of stuff that does happen. There's a ton of these that are coming up at the NCAA level. We'll see what they do with that. But it's becoming an issue at the NCAA level. So here's the rule. We go to Article 10 of the bylaws. It is not permissible for student athletes to gamble on college sports as well as pro sports. So this one, again, I talked about how this stuff is not evergreen. They, about a month ago, they were going to allow student athletes and the coaches to begin to gamble on pro sports, and it was set to go into play on 11/22. And on 11/21, they backed off that because we got the stuff going on with the NBA and the manipulation going on there. So they pulled back on that one day before the final deadline, and they said, no, we're not going to do that. So as of now, going forward, college players cannot gamble on college or pro sports, and that's probably a pretty smart idea. Also, the athletes cannot provide information to individuals involved in gambling. And the athletes are required, it's not optional, you got to report up to compliance if there's any offers coming in of money, gifts, to provide information and to manipulate the game. So that's not not optional. You got to report that up. So that's a way that the kids get in trouble because they got their friends, they got their teammates, they didn't do anything wrong, but they find out that information on the text message that somebody's doing something wrong. You got to kick that up. Otherwise, the kid's going to be in trouble. And a lot of these guys don't go pro. It's going to be out there, and they're going to be looking for a job a few years down the road. HR does a Google search. They see the problems on the team when you were there, and that's going to come up in the interviews. What did you know? What did you do about it? So let's look at a no-show job, Kentucky football. They reached an agreement with the NCAA on impermissible benefits in the football program. What hopefully we'll all pay attention to here is this is not a one-off. This is stuff that's going on again and again. And at Kentucky football, it's not just one player stealing wages for a week. What we have are at least 11 football players with no-show jobs for looks like probably a year between 2021 and 22. So that is systemic on the problem, a systemic problem on the team, and it's going to be a real problem. So when you get information on this, you got to kick it up because there's always going to be some kind of a text or email trail that's going to get people in trouble. Here's another fun one for extra benefits. It's not just the players, but it is the coaches. It's really hard to believe that this stuff goes on, but it does, and it's not a one-off. I'm going to take a sip of water here real quick. So what we got here is the coach at UNLV, or the former coach, as you can probably imagine. So the former coach was knowingly providing impermissible benefits to student athletes and instructed them to lie about those benefits. So the school found that Scott violated ethical conduct rules when he knowingly provided student athlete with international airfare and then instructed the student athlete to lie about it and falsify compliance documents. So it's bad enough to knowingly provide the benefit, but then when the adult, the coach, the authority figure tells the player, I need you to lie about this, and I need you to falsify the documents and sign your name under penalty of perjury. That's not terrific leadership. So here's the rule on it. And I brought this out of the University of Washington's student guide, just so you can kind of see how the universities present this to the athletes. Sometimes the NCAA rules can get a little bit wonky. They give you a little bit of narrative with the college student athlete guides. So the UW says you cannot accept anything of value from the athletic department or a booster. That includes, airfare, use of car, meals. You can't get a Big Mac, can't get a Cadillac, none of that stuff. There's no de minimis exception. You cannot accept anything of value from the athletic department or a booster where that becomes a violation. Also, this is a fun one. You can imagine what happens around campus. The athlete cannot accept free or reduced cost merchandise or services from any merchants. So you got a 20-year-old kid. He has a great game, goes down to the Shakey's pizza parlor Sunday afternoon, and they want to give him a free pizza because he had such a good game. But if you're a student athlete, you can't go around town picking up free pizzas, because that becomes a violation, because they're not just giving out free pizzas to the general public. So you got to be really careful with that stuff and have those conversations again on the front end so they don't get themselves in trouble when the temptations come up. All right, so let's jump into the transgender student athlete policy change. It's difficult because there, you know, there's going to be strong opinions on both sides, but hopefully everyone can be kind of respectful on this one, because it's difficult. It just is, and it kind of came out of nowhere, and it became the topic of conversation over the past 4 or 5 years. So let's see what the NCAA said on the policy change. He said, "We strongly believe that clear, consistent, and uniform eligibility standards would best serve today's student athletes instead of a patchwork of conflicting state laws and court decisions. To that end, President Trump's EO provides a good standard." So the NCAA, we'll jump into the policy quickly here, but the NCAA said, yeah, we support the policy change. We're exhausted. We just need a clear, simple rule. Let's move forward. So not much fight from the NCAA, and I wouldn't consider the NCAA a far-right organization. They're pretty progressive for the most part, and they said, yeah, we support the policy. Let's all move forward. How about the UW? I'm up here in Seattle. The UW is the bluest school in the bluest state, in the bluest county. In the blue, it's a very blue place to be, and they said, yeah, we're going to follow the NCAA guidelines on this. So the NCAA, we support it. The UW, yeah, we're not going to fight it. We'll go along with this. We're exhausted. We got all this stuff going on with name, image, likeness, revenue sharing, and all this. It's just we got to get these rules in place and move on and roll the ball out in the court. So they're good to go on this, and let's jump into the policy itself. So the main changes for the NCAA is that for student athletes who are assigned male at birth, they cannot play on the women's team in game competition. So when USC plays USC, can't be in the game. No scholarships for women's sports and no waivers. So this is a bright line test. If you are assigned male at birth, cannot be in the women's game. Definitions, if you're new to this, sex assigned at birth, it is male or female, no other options on the birth records. Gender ID, that's a little more fluid, that's the internal sense of gender, male, female, non-binary, and transgender is gender ID or expression that is different from assigned at birth. So if you're new to that, hopefully it just gives a little bit of context. All right, so let's go to the policy itself. What do we got? For the dudes, anybody can play. They roll the ball out, and here we go. They don't need your life story, but all student athletes, male, female, however you identify, you can practice or you can compete in the games. And there have been some women at the NCAA. They play on the women's soccer team, and they also can play as the place kicker sometimes. So for the guys, show up and play. They don't care. For the women's teams, here's what we got to do as of 2/6/25. For a student athlete assigned male at birth, you cannot play in the games. You are allowed to practice with the women's team. For student athletes who are assigned female at birth, for the games, student athlete assigned female at birth and taking testosterone may not compete in the games, but you can be at the practice. So for the women's sports, it's pretty clear what we have to do these days. Cannot be in the games, but importantly, they can be part of the team for practice, you know, team events. Maybe they go to team dinners, team movie night. They bring on leadership speakers for the team. The transgender student can be part of that. But when USC plays UCLA, cannot be in the court for those games. All right, so we're going to jump into House versus NCAA. This is a massive watershed case that has come up that is going to change everything. We're going to do kind of a highlight of the key points. If you do have the chance to get like a 2 to 3 hour CLE and you're doing a lot of sports law, take it, because there's a lot of nuances and things to keep track of. But basically, this is a class action settlement from June of 25. And the issues involve student athletes and their inability to collect name, image, likeness money. So they kind of got caught in the wash between what we have now with name, image, likeness, and what they were not able to get as they were a student athlete. So they want to go and collect that money. The class size is about 400,000 student athletes between 2016 and 2024. We have three classes of athletes for the back payment. The first class is football and men's basketball. They get the most money. Women's basketball is next. And then third is the other sports. So if you play badminton, you know, you're not doing much for the university as far as revenues go. But this issue with the three classes is creating some Title IX issues, because the women's basketball are saying we need a bigger cut here under Title IX. So we'll see how this plays out. There's some lawsuits going on with that. So for those former students who lost the nil, there is a $2.8 billion payment that's going to be sent out to the kids over 10 years to those classes up there. For the current athletes going forward over the next 10 years, they do get to share in revenues from the athletic department with the university. So in this lawsuit, we have House versus NCAA. And if you're part of one of the Big Five conferences, you are a defendant. So that's the SEC, the Big 12, the Big 10, the ACC, and what's left of the Pac-12. I don't know who's playing in that anymore, but those are the Big Five. They're defendants. If you are part of a conference that's outside of the Big Five, every year those schools in those other conferences have to decide if they want to opt in or opt out of the settlement. And you can go back and forth. So you're opting into the revenue share or opting out on an annual basis. It's going to be kind of fun to watch how that happens. But, you know, if you're not a school that can compete with an Alabama or Notre Dame, they might say, you know, we don't want to do the revenue share. We can't compete with them anyways. And the formula down here below, what you need to know is that for the Division I's, if they opt in, each of those schools is allowed to share up to $20 million from the athletic revenues, sponsorships, ticket sales, media rights. So each school has up to $20 million. It's up to the school to distribute to the student athletes. So that's kind of a good deal for the student athletes. I mean, you don't, you know, you're not going to make a lot of money if you don't have the student athletes out on the field. So they should get a cut of this money. But again, it's optional for the schools. They can opt in, opt out on the revenue share, and the schools can decide how much they want to spend on the revenue share, and the schools can decide how they want to distribute it to the student athletes. So this kind of gives you a visual of what it looks like. The revenue share is $20 million, which is great in South Bend, Indiana. That goes a long ways with Notre Dame. Probably not great out in Los Angeles. The roster limits, which is kind of nice. What they did is they got rid of the scholarship limits on the teams, and pretty much anybody on the roster now, the schools can decide to give them full scholarships, partial scholarships, or no scholarships. So a lot of flexibility, which is good for the student athlete. So in football, as an example, the roster is set at 105. So you can have up to 105 guys on the team, and you can figure out how you want to divvy up those scholarships for any of those guys. Third-party nil reporting. If the student athlete gets a nil deal with Nike and it's at least $600, you're obligated to report that to the College Sports Commission, which is over there on the far right. For high school juniors, this is where it's going to get tricky for the student athletes at the high school level. And if you work with high school, you know, sports parents in divorce or something like that, this is something you want to have conversations with them about. So for the high school juniors, this is going to be tough. They need to keep track of payments and records during high school from their first day as a junior. They don't have to report anything. Just put those records aside. And then once they get recruited to a college, they're on campus, they must report that to the CSC within 14 days of setting foot on campus at UCLA. So it's got to be done within 14 days or before their first game. And they're going to take a look at that. And if that high school kid had some problematic endorsement deals, maybe he got a deal with a local cannabis shop when he turned 18, CSC is going to look at that and say, no, that's not good. Pay that money back. We got to get rid of that one. Associated entities and individuals, these are, you know, kind of the collectives. Think of the difference here. Nike and Red Bull, they want to be everywhere, promoting at every school. But the associated entity wants to promote a specific school. They want to promote athletes from a single school. And there's going to be a test on that they have to keep track of called valid business purpose, which means it has to be a legitimate deal where you're promoting goods or services. And it's got to meet the range of compensation tests, which is you're not just giving them a truckload of money for doing nothing. It's got to be within range of what's reasonable. So on the far right there, this is the new enforcement tool. This is outside of the NCAA. They're not affiliated. They set up what's called the College Sports Commission, the CSC, and they will be enforcing the rules, and it's going to get the NCAA out of that so they can do what they do best, and we'll let the CSC handle this. It's going to be interesting. What I heard is they have a pretty small staff, something like 7 or 10 people that look at these name, image, likeness deals. So I think some of the deals are getting delayed. We'll see how it goes. Do take a look, and I've got these in the resources, the House versus NCAA Q&A, as well as the CSC FAQs, and this will give you a really good overview of what we're talking about today. But there's a lot of things to keep track of with House versus NCAA. So for those who are new to this, revenue share, again, that's between the school and the student athlete. Endorsement deals, that can be between the school or a third party, Nike, and the student athlete, or it can be between the associated entity and the student athlete, as we talked about. And again, the associated entity, just kind of think of that as a collective. They support a single school. They want to promote Alabama and the Alabama athletes. But Nike, they want to be everywhere. Nike wants to be at Alabama as well as Auburn. Again, it has to meet that valid business purpose test. It's got to promote a good or service that's sold to the public and meet the range of compensation tests. So it's not fair market value. It's going to be a little bit more flexible. You got to take a look at the marketability of the athlete, of the school, of the sport. Got to look at the requirements under the contract for the endorsement deal. And then they'll say, yeah, this is kind of, it's within range. It's good enough. And then you can go along with that. CSC, that's the enforcement group. They are going to be in charge of looking at revenue share. Again, those schools have $20 million. How are they distributing it? They will look at the rosters, got to have those roster limits, and the NIL deals. The CSC has set up a platform, it's called MilGo. So for any deal that is $600 or more, you have to report it within 5 business days of the agreement. And it's voluntary if the deal is for less than $600 or if you pre-sign. So if it's kind of this sort of funky setup with royalties and things like that, before the kid signs it, it's probably a good idea to submit it to CSC through Neil Gill, get the sign off on that, and then you're good to go. But what happens if the CSC rejects the Neil deal? They say, this doesn't meet the range of compensation. It's way overboard. We don't think this is a good deal. It's not legitimate. 3 options for the student athlete. They can cancel it. They can revise it with the company and resubmit it. Or if the kid thinks it's a good deal, they can go to arbitration through the CSC. So this is really good. I like this arbitration setup because it's quick. So the kid wants to fight it. and he or she can submit request for arbitration within 14 days of the rejection. The arbitration will be held within 45 days, and then you get the result in 5 days. So you're not going to wait around, for 8-9 months to try to find out what's going to happen, because the companies are going to move on at that point to somebody else. What's also good here is the athlete does not have to pay for any arbitration or fees. Athlete goes to arbitration, she loses, she doesn't have to pay that arbitration fee or expense. So that's kind of nice. Take another sip of water here, just one sec. All right, so let's do a hypothetical for how this might look for a revenue share agreement. So we got a kid in high school, he plays football and he's a McDonald's All-American. He's the best in the biz. And he's got a deal here on the table for $250K. That's not bad. So the high school quarterback is entering his senior year of high school. On August 1st, the university extends a written revenue offer for $250K. He's a high school kid, so he can't sign it yet. He's not on campus at the college yet, so he can't get that money. Between August and November, the quarterback is going to shop that around to different schools in the country. Can you beat this? Can I get me some more money? In December of the senior year at high school, the kid decides to sign with the university and sign for the revenue share agreement. So you're locked in on that, but you don't get the money because you're still in high school and not on the campus. So now we move forward to college. He gets the signing incentive. It's going to be paid after university enrollment. Let's say he gets $50K out of that $250K. Shows up on campus as a freshman in September. Here's $50K. Have fun with that. Don't be paying other students to do your homework so you can go out and get endorsement deals. And then we have January 1st of the freshman year, he gets another $100K. And January 1st of sophomore years, he gets the other $100K. So the $250 is paid out at separate times. This is just an example of how it might work. If the student athlete does decide to transfer as a sophomore, he's not going to get that second year $100K. The school that he transfers to is going to be responsible for a buyout and be responsible for covering that $100K. So this is really how it works. You can sign these deals in high school. You're not going to get paid until you're on campus. And if the kids are transferring back and forth, then you got to keep that in mind. There's going to be a buyout fee paid by the transferee school, and they'll be responsible for covering that contract amount too. What is still on the table? We've got plenty of stuff that is not settled yet with House versus NCAA. Not evergreen, stuff is changing all the time. The NCAA, they want antitrust protection, similar to what you see in pro sports. In the NFL, you have the draft, you have a salary cap, you have restricted free agency. So the NFL is telling the player, you go play in this city, we're gonna limit how much money you can make, and you cannot leave cities for 3 or 4 years, whatever it is. So they can put those conditions in place to protect the sport, and it kind of limits the amount of money that the players can get. The NCAA has been fighting on this for a while, so we'll see what happens. Our student athletes, employees, who knows, still open. I really doubt that's going to go forward. That would create massive compliance and administrative issues if they turn the student athletes into employees. It's open. They're still fighting for it, but I doubt that's going to go anywhere. What about the states and state income tax? They're always competing with each other, right? As soon as the NIL and the revenue share stuff started showing up, the states that have state income tax started fighting with each other because you want to put the best conditions in place to recruit those athletes. And in Florida, Texas, you don't have state income tax. California, good luck out there. But what's kind of funny is you watch states like Georgia and Alabama, big SEC states, they have state income tax, and they're trying to put together a program for exemptions on state income tax on name, image, likeness. Show me the incentive, and I'll show you the outcome. So that's how it's going to be with the states kind of jockeying with each other with the name, image, likeness. And I talked about this a little bit earlier, but Title IX, that's going to be out there for a while. with the revenue share. Title IX does not apply to any third-party endorsement deals because that's between, you know, Nike and the athlete. That's outside of the school. But with the revenue share program, there's going to be issues on how the schools distribute that money, because if they take that $20 million bucks and they say, let's give all $20 million to the quarterback, that can be a problem because it's not fair to the women's sports where you need proportionality. So we'll see how that goes. There are some lawsuits kind of hanging out there right now, and we'll have to see how that goes. We're going to skip over the Washington Uniform Athlete Agency Act. You can read through this. Really depends on what state you work out of, but your state might follow the Uniform Athlete Act, or they might not, like California. California has what's called the Miller-Aiello Act. It applies to pro athletes as well as amateur athletes. Most states will follow the Uniform Athlete Act, which applies to student athletes like Washington State. What I do want you to pay attention to, though, depending on what state you work in, they probably have a section on what attorneys can do. Again, this is for agents who work with the student athletes on the endorsement deals. But there's separation between what an agent does and what an attorney does. An attorney's not calling at Nike and trying to get a deal, because that's the job of a certified agent. So if you are an attorney, they make it clear that an agent does not include a licensed attorney when they're providing services customarily provided by members of that profession. What they cannot do as an attorney, if you are a non-agent attorney, which you can't do, which the line that you can't cross, is you cannot recruit or solicit the athlete to enter into an agency contract with you. You can't offer compensation, try to get a pro deal for that student athlete with a pro team. And you cannot set up some kind of funky consideration program for providing services to that student athlete. So an example might be, if you're looking at some kind of contract with the school for revenue share or some kind of an endorsement deal, as an attorney, you can be in the office doing that kind of work. You can't solicit those contracts with Nike. You can be in your office looking it over as an attorney, providing some guidance to the student athlete and the family. But if you set up some kind of weird compensation system that is outside of what you normally do, you've got your normal fee agreement, and you start setting up weird payment systems that are downstream when the money starts rolling in, that's going to get you in trouble. So there's a clear line between what an agent does, solicit deals, and what an attorney does, employment law, contract law, some guidance. And as long as you're following these rules, you're not soliciting, you're not setting up different compensation plans, then you're pretty safe as an attorney at the table. So let's jump into the high school level. We got all kinds of fun stuff going on in high school. And I love this case from back in the day. Simpler times, right? We got the Texas cheerleader case, and Mom Holloway made headlines when she cooked up a scheme. She wanted to hire a hitman to bump off the mom of her daughter's main rival on the cheerleader.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is VAN, V-A-N, all lowercase, VAN. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is VAN, V-A-N, all lowercase, VAN. Please take a moment and write this down.
Team, that is not mom of the year when you're trying to get a hitman to take out your daughter's biggest rival's mom. That's not good sports parenting. So how about these issues at the high school level? We have gender identity expression. That's going to be the difference in the transgender policy between the high school level and the NCAA. Endorsement deals, and then we'll look at some Q&A for maintaining amateur status as a student athlete. In this, I really recommend if you are a divorce attorney and you have clients with kids who are playing sports, chances are mom and dad don't talk to each other, they're not on the same page with the sports, and they're going to do stuff that gets the kids in trouble with not paying attention to what they can do and what they can't do. So if you're a divorce attorney, and you get familiar with your state's interschoolastic requirements for the student athletes, That can be a huge benefit for your clients. So this is at the high school level for Washington. Check with your state, it could differ. But in Washington State, athletes will participate in programs consistent with their gender ID or the gender most consistently expressed. That's kind of a tricky one to go through, but I guess what they're saying is if you were born male and you most consistently identify with being female most of the time, then you can play in the girls' sports. That's pretty much what I get out of that. Also, the student athlete is not required to go back every year and fill out some kind of, you know, certification that they want to still identify with that gender. You do it once and you don't have to go back again and convince them. Keep these numbers in mind. It's you know, regardless of what side you're on here. But the general idea for national numbers for student athletes at the high school level, you got around 8 million kids playing high school sports. 1% gender, transgender, let's say, that is 80,000 kids that are getting impacted. So whatever side you're on, you know, that can fill a stadium of kids. So, you know, try to be respectful for both sides. The issue kind of came out of nowhere over the last few years, and it took up a lot of oxygen. So it created a lot of kind of feelings on both sides of the argument. But keep in mind, these are kids. So if there is conflict, keep the conflict between the adults. Go attack the school district, go attack the state, but kind of leave the kids alone that are on the field. Here's how Washington State does it for the sports. If we have a single sport and two teams like soccer, the boys play with the boys and the girls play with the girls. And again, that's based on how you self-identify. But we have a boys team, girls team. How do you self-identify? Okay, go play with those guys. If the school only provides one team for the boys, tackle football, the girls are allowed to join. If the school provides only one team for the girls, the boys cannot join unless there's limited opportunities for the boys. So an example might be in the spring, let's say they have a girls softball team. But for the boys, they don't have a baseball team, a softball team. There's really nothing going on in the spring. At that point, the boy, he self-identifies as a boy, he can join the girls' team and play, and that creates a co-ed team, so there's no sanctions and no penalties for that. But it's kind of a smart way to do it, gives them a little bit more flexibility for the kids that are just trying to get out there and play some games. For Appendix 3 in the WIAA guidebook, they do provide some definitions here. We've kind of covered most of these already, so I'm just going to focus on the ones down at the bottom there. I mean, it's the transgender issue was new for all of us to try to get familiar with, so this might be new for you. It was new for me. Cisgender, I kind of always wonder what does that mean? So cisgender is a person who's assigned sex aligns with their gender ID. So somebody who is assigned female at birth, and whose gender identity is female. Transgender, again, that's a person whose gender ID differs from their assigned sex. And then non-binary, that is used to describe a variety of gender identities that do not fall into one of the two traditional categories. So hopefully that helps clear it up, the correct usage, so we're not offending anyone. Cisgender person, transgender person, and non-binary. So again, this is all kind of new for me over the past few years. It might be new for you. Regardless of what side of the table we're on, want to be respectful to the other people that are there. The WIAA also provides some additional clarification. This was brand new to me. When I heard transitioning, I thought that was a medical procedure that was coming up. But they want to make clear that each person's transition is distinct. Steps can include a combination of legal steps, medical procedures, or simply social changes. So they start to use different pronouns, change their appearance. That qualifies as transitioning. It's not just going in for a medical procedure. So if you're new to the issue, hopefully that helps out a little bit. All right, we're going to jump into endorsements at the high school level. If, again, I'll stress this so much. If you do divorce law and you got mom and dad, they don't talk to each other, you can be a huge benefit if you get familiar with the endorsement requirements and make sure the parents are doing the right thing so they don't make the student athlete ineligible. You get kicked off the high school team and the scholarships options start drying up, and you start to not hear from the colleges as much once you get kicked off the high school team. So at the high school level in Washington State, the student, the uncle, or anybody else on behalf of the student cannot enter into an endorsement deal in any way that relates to the kids' association to their high school. The result, immediate loss of eligibility. So you got these kind of family members hanging around, and they're taking a little kickback fee and getting things set up here, and they're putting a connection with the high school. That's the kind of thing that get you in trouble. You got to know the rules ahead of time and make sure you're doing the right thing. So in Washington, the student athlete is allowed to pursue endorsement deals, provided it's not affiliated with the school. Check with your state. Typically, this is allowed. Some states don't allow it. Some do. Student athlete is not allowed to wear the team uniform or use school marks, and the school cannot promote the NIL deal. So the Washington State, you can do a nil deal, show up with in school colors with a t-shirt and your number, but you cannot wear a letterman's jacket, your uniform, baseball cap, anything with the school logo. So it's gotta have that separation there. Also, if you do business law and you have a small business down the street from the school and they want to do a promotion for the kid, let's say the kid just got awarded the McDonald's All-American. So you are the in-house counsel, and the small shop wants to put something out to congratulate the kid. You can do that, but it gets a little bit tricky. Let's look at the rules here down at the bottom for a congratulatory advertisement. So the small business can include the student's name only, not the photograph. The business can put its trademark on the congratulatory advertisement, but you cannot include the product or service in the advertisement. So you run a pancake house, you can include the kid's name, good job Jimmy Street. You can include your trademark, but you cannot include a big stack of pancakes next to Jimmy Street. This is the stuff that the small businesses are going to mess up on, and this is the stuff that the parents are going to mess up on all the time. So here's a summary of what the kids can do in Washington State and retain their eligibility. So the student is allowed to be a pro in sport A and an amateur in sport B at the same time. The kids and the family can accept actual and necessary expenses for an athletic trip. So you have a select basketball camp coming up. They can pay the airfare, the housing, the meals, and that's okay. You can accept that. So this one gets tricky. The students can accept merchandise up to $500 per year based on performance in that sport. That gets tricky. So the kid plays golf on the high school team, and she's pretty good. She goes out and wins a local municipal tournament, and she gets a $500 golf bag for winning the tournament. Plus, she plays on the high school team. That is allowed, but she's also capped out. Parents don't talk to each other. 3 months later, she's with the other parent. She wins another tournament, and they want to give her a mountain bike for winning the tournament. It's a mountain bike based on her performance in golf. Parents aren't talking. She accepts it, and what do you know? She's now ineligible. So they got to really pay attention to these rules, so they don't get themselves in trouble. If the merchandise is part of a camp fee, you pay $1,000 for a Nike camp and you get a pair of shoes, that is excluded from the cap because that is part of the fee. It's not a gift. Gift cards are allowed, no cash, and it can't be exchangeable for gifts. So flip the card over, make sure it says not exchangeable for gift, and that is okay to accept that gift card. The kids can instruct and officiate for pay. So it's kind of funny, you get the high school kids out there with the youngins, and they get to officiate, and they get paid for that, and that is not a problem. So long as they're not getting paid $5,000 a game, if they're getting paid fair market value, good to go. Student athlete is allowed to wear like a t-shirt or a hoodie, with their jersey number and the school colors for endorsement deals. So it's a plain t-shirt, it's got their jersey number, no IP involved, good to go. Student may represent him or herself and their town, but they cannot identify the team and the school in the NIL deal. So this stuff, for those of us in law, we can read through this. Yeah, kind of got it. But if you're the sports parent, they're working two jobs. They've got to go down to the orthodontist appointment. They've got parents who have health issues. They're just maxed out. They can't keep track of any of this. So if you do divorce law, you're going to have some clients that play sports. Please, read through the rules so you can kind of help them out. So let's do a hypothetical here. You are a divorce law attorney and you have a client. The parent frantically calls you 3 minutes before the radio interview of her son, who plays quarterback for the high school. So KJR wants to interview the quarterback for player of the game, and KJR wants to give the kid a $25 IHOP gift card for football performance. And she's frantic. She doesn't know the rules. Can he do that? She doesn't want him to get kicked off the team so he can go get a scholarship. But you know what the rule is, right? To maintain football amateur status, the QB cannot endorse IHOP because this is on the field. The kid is in his football uniform, so he cannot endorse IHOP. And the $25 gift card has to apply to the $500 limit for the sport of football. So if the kid is maxed out already, if he's accepted $500, no, you cannot accept that gift card for football. But if he hasn't accepted anything yet under the cap, good to go. So again, he is on the field in the uniform. He's all geared up in high school stuff. Can't endorse IHOP because of that. But you can accept the $25 as long as you're under the cap. How about this one? Let's say you do business law. The car dealership is your client. And the car dealer calls you frantically 3 minutes before QB is going to do an advertising deal. So in our hypo, the local car dealer wants to feature the high school quarterback in a print advertisement. The QB will wear a plain t-shirt. It's got his uniform number 12, and we have the exact same school colors. Plain t-shirt, jersey number, school colors. The QB will also identify his town. So is that allowed? And you know the answer. The t-shirt is allowed provided the school name, logo, and marks are not on the t-shirt, and the QB may identify himself and his town, but the QB may not identify his high school. So it gets kind of fun if you live in a small town and there's one high school. Yeah, you kind of know what's going on, but you can identify yourself, you can identify your town, you just can't identify the high school or wear the letterman's jacket, and you're good to go. So we'll do one more here. This is where it gets tricky, too, for the sports parents on the timelines. They will mess this up. They're busy. If you do divorce law, I'll just keep saying it. You can be a big help if you can help them out on the requirements for high school sports. So in Washington State, you get the $500 per sports. That's fine. But the academic year runs from August through July. So for high school, August through July, you can accept $500 for that period of time. Now with the NCAA revenue share, the academic year runs July through June. So we've got that kind of overlap time. And parents, they got a kid in college playing ball. They got a kid in high school playing ball. They think that the academic year is going to be the same for both. And we know in Washington State, you can accept merchandise based on performance in that sport, $500 between that time frame. So here's where it gets tricky. The high school athlete, she plays golf on the team, and she plays in Muni tournaments. She accepts a set of Callaway golf clubs from winning a tournament in September. She is capped. So in July, she wins a second tournament, and they want to give her a set of golf balls for $100 for winning the tournament. That's going to be a violation. That's 10 months later. The parents are all messed up in the timelines between the NCAA and Washington State, and now she has violated it, and the kid is off the team through no fault of her own. The parents weren't paying attention. So keep that stuff in mind for the high school level. You can have a lot of impact if you are doing sports law at the pro level. Make sure you know what you're going to do ahead of time. You're going to get into some really dicey situations. There's only so many seats at the table for lawyers as well as agents. So you got to make sure ahead of time what you're going to do and what you're not willing to do to keep a seat at the table. If you go into the NCAA, if you're an attorney for agents, or if you're an attorney for the schools, there's turmoil. Whatever we talked about today, it's going to change. They got to kind of shake out the revenue share and see how that goes. But it will not be the same a year from now. And at the high school level, I appreciate what you do out there. If you do have a chance to help the sports parents out with the rules at the high school level, you can make a huge impact to them. They're going to get confused on this stuff, and they do need the help, especially if they're not communicating with each other and they're divorced and they're just not on the same page, and that can get the kid kicked off the team pretty quickly. When you get kicked off the team for violations, those scholarship offers start drying up. So here's my contact information. It's a fun topic, so always feel free to reach out. I appreciate the time and hope everybody has a great holiday season, and feel free to reach out. And again, I appreciate the time. Take care.